So today's shiur is dedicated to Ili Nishmas, Mr. Rosen, Alav Shalom, Shlomo Zundel ben Reb Tzvi Hirsch. So many of us in this room remember him, and he was a participant in this shiur. I can still see him right now. I can hear his Chicago/Yiddish kind of intonation. And Cy and Bonnie, who are dedicating the shiur, are having a special weekend. They're in New York, and their grandson was named yesterday. He emailed me last night. His grandson was named Adir Shlomo after his father. So it's really special for their family, and learning should be Lili Nishmaso. Of course, it's wonderful to be a part of that. So this morning, we're going to continue with our series. And I'm very excited about this because I venture to guess this is going to be a sefer that many have not heard of. I can tell you, I never heard of it until I came across it in a bookstore somewhere. I don't even remember where. The sefer that we're going to learn together today is called Shalal David. Shalal really means the spoils of war. Kind of the collections of David. And it's published by Machon Yerushalayim, which is the publisher of several other volumes that I was first introduced to in the YU Library. The YU Library, the Mendel Gottesman Judaica Library, is extremely extensive in its Svarim collection. It's outstanding. And I don't remember exactly why it was that I happened to come across a reference to a sefer written on Kachim called Yad David. Yad David, that was the name of the sefer. And when I first encountered this sefer years ago when we were still living in the Heights, I think we must have been learning some Kachim Sugya at that time, which is how I ended up with that sefer. I opened up the sefer and I was introduced not just to incredible Chidushe Torah, but into a whole world. Gina, you can sit here. There's a place. there's the whole world. That's what happens. That was amazing. And I had never realized was out there. And that's what I'd like to share today, in addition to the Shtikl Torah from this sefer on the Torah called Shalal David. So to do that, we'll begin with two narratives. The biographies of two men who are going to intersect, and that will frame, I think, the context for what is, to me, one of the most fascinating episodes in modern Jewish history. So let's begin on the back page, back of your front cover page. This is a brief biography I ripped off from a website called SparkNotes. SparkNotes is not, let's just say, it's not exactly an academic enterprise, but if you need a cheat sheet, it's a good place to go. So I cut it down a little bit just to give you the overall biography of a man who is known to us as Napoleon Bonaparte. Napoleon is born August 15th, 1769 in Corsica. In 1779, he begins studying at the Royal Academy. He becomes an officer. He continues to study. And then on July 14th, 1789, the Paris mob storms the Bastille, and that begins the huge period of upheaval known as the French Revolution. So for a couple of years, there was this huge upheaval known as the... first it was the... I forget what it was called, the General... what was the name of it? I forget exactly the original permutation of the French government that went from 1789 till 1791. And then in 1791, things shift. Then in 1792, King Louis the 16th is dethroned. Then in 1793, he's actually executed, and that initiates something called the Reign of Terror for 2 years. Finally, in 1799, Napoleon, who is now, and I cut this out, but he's become an increasingly influential general in the French army. He becomes the first consul of the new French government. And in 1800, in 1802, he becomes the consulate for life. In 1804, he crowns himself Emperor of France. And then you see things kind of move on. There's a significant military history here, which we'll get back to this period of time in a minute. 1805, the Battle of Trafalgar. So some of us are familiar with the Battle of Trafalgar and Lord Nelson, because if you've ever had the chance to visit London, Some of us have been to London, and there is a very famous plaza there known as Trafalgar Square, and there is a huge statue of a guy by the name of Admiral Nelson. This is probably, I don't know, maybe the most famous landmark in terms of meeting up places in London. 1806, he names his brother the King of Naples. He has several family members who he basically puts in charge of different countries across Europe. 1807, he defeats the Russians in the Battle of Friedland, and he keeps moving eastward until 1812, when he hits Moscow and things start to go sour. December 18th, 1812, he returns to Paris. March 17th, Prussia declares war on France. Then they fall to Spain. Paris falls in 1814, and Napoleon is out. He essentially abdicates and is exiled in 1814, and then he does the same thing a second time. He comes back, and finally he dies in exile in 1821. This is the story of the life of Napoleon Bonaparte. Okay, that's one story. And as part of this general story, you realize what's going on at the same time, let's say, in the greater world. So at the beginning of this picture, Thomas Jefferson is the President of the United States. We're just kind of getting off to a good start here in America. The War of 1812 is taking place during this crucial time. In the Jewish world, if you go move over to Eastern Europe, there is the burgeoning, nascent movement of Hasidism that's taking hold in many places in Eastern Europe. And there was actually quite a vigorous debate about Napoleon among Jewish rabbinic, especially in Hasidic circles. Some who were very pro-Napoleon, so for example, Reb Mendel Rimnover was a prominent Hasidic master who was a supporter of Napoleon, who davened for Napoleon's success. And then there were others, like the Koznetzer Magen and the Chosef Lublin, who were opposed to Napoleon because they were concerned that the emancipation that Napoleon brought with him would negatively impact the Jewish community, the Jewish faith community, in terms of assimilation. Okay, this is one man, one story. A lot of us know a lot about this particular individual. But there is another man, and that's who I'd like to introduce to us right now. And this is a great rabbinic figure, but unknown in many circles, known as Rav Yosef David Zinsheim. Rav Yosef David Zinsheim is the author of this work called Yad David, which you're looking at in front of you. This is a new publication, but the original publication was in Tav Kuf Nun Tes, 1899, let's say. Sefer Yad David Chelek Rishon. It is a commentary on the Shas, authored by Rav David Zinsheim. Who was Rav David Zinsheim? So, generally speaking, you don't have first-hand autobiographical information of great Rabbanim in their Svarim, but in this case, we do. So what I printed for you here on the next two pages, oh, I put them backwards, actually. Go to page 4, comes before page 3, sorry, is the introduction that Rav David Zinsheim wrote to his Sefer called the Yad David. And he actually tells you his life story right here in starting on page 4. He's born in 1745 to his father, who was a rabbi in Trier, the Av Bezna of Trier, whose father's name was Rav Yitzchak Zinsheim. And then, also in another place in Kila Kedosha, Niederenheim. So he's born in Trier, so he's an Alsatian Jew. So Alsace-Lorraine is the area of France that borders Germany, near the Rhine River. So depending on what day it is, some days it's France, some days it's Germany. This area was extremely important in the development of halachic learning. So, for example, Rashi learned in the Rhine Valley in a community called Worms. There were two others, Speyer and Mainz. These were great rabbinic communities. They were destroyed in the Crusades, but in general, afterwards, and then there was more destruction, the Rindfleisch massacres and plenty of other massacres. Every other day there's another massacre, unfortunately. But these were very vibrant and important Jewish communities along the Rhine Valley, both on the Germanic side, on the French side. So there's a lot of life there, and these are specifically Ashkenazi French communities. As opposed to, if you go further down in France, like in Marseille and other places like that, you'll find heavy Sephardic influence, because they're close to Spain, they're close to Morocco. So Reb David Zinsheim, his father is a rabbi in Alsace. He's born in 1745. Who does he study under? I put the little underline there. Adoni Ovi Mori Varabi Haniskar. He says, I learned how to learn by studying with my father. I'm on page 4 on the right-hand side where I put the little words, my father. Then he describes later in the underline, in Shnas Tatzliach, Niftachu Beis Medrash HaGodol HaHukam Be'ir Bisha, also known as Bishheim, through Al Yedei Gisi HaGevir HaManoach HaMeruman Naftali Hertz Mendelsheim. So my brother-in-law, he writes, Rav Naftali Hertz Mendelsheim, establishes a Beis Medrash in a city called Bishheim, and that's where I become the Rosh Hashiva, says Rav David Zinsheimer. Okay. Then he resettles in a nearby location. You see where I put the next underline. I learned there for a couple of years until halachatz, I put the word Strasbourg, sha'oz halachatz v'harash melchama gavru. But now there's unsettling tenor. There's war. There's upheaval. So he moves from Bishheim to v'echricho sonu l'leches le'ir Strasbourg. That's where we were learning until we got to Seder Kachim. So he moves from Bishheim, which is not far from Strasbourg, to Strasbourg. So Strasbourg was a great, important city, also in that area east of Paris. You can go there today. I'll be makir tov to my parents, because years ago, when I was still studying in Yeshiva College, somehow I was not an honor student, but they permitted me to join the honors trip to France. So we had the opportunity to study French Jewish history, which was very interesting to me, to study French Jewish history in Paris for several weeks. And I had the opportunity to visit some of these places in eastern France, like Colmar and Strasbourg and Rashi's hometown of Troyes. Very fascinating experience. My French is terrible. I just know how to say, where is the bathroom? I still today. That's all you need to know. But they don't speak
any... You understand the answer, too.
Well... right and left, I got. Which is where's the bathroom? Wow. Right and left. But they refuse to speak any English. But it's a Gewalt Gesach. Everybody speaks Hebrew. Everybody can go anywhere. And even if they know English, they won't speak English to you. But they speak Hebrew. So I had the opportunity to really visit these places. And there was a very vibrant Jewish community, especially in Strasbourg, which was like an Ir V'Em B'Yisrael, so to speak. It was one of the most famous, at this time, by the 18th century, it was one of the biggest centers of Jewish learning in Western Europe. So he comes to Strasbourg, he becomes a rabbi in Strasbourg. Now what does he describe? Vayhi b'shnas tuf kuf nun dalid. What is shnas tuf kuf nun dalid? 1793. What's happening in France in 1793? The reign of terror. Yemei hapkuda, yemei hazam. It became the days of rage. That's what, by the way, today, when the Arabs decide that there's going to be a terror day in Israel, what do they call it? They call it Yom Hazam. That's Arabic. Hazam is like za'am, rage. So sometimes you see in the news, the Arabs proclaim today is a day of rage. It's called Yom Hazam. It comes from the word Za'am. So he says, Yemei Hazam, Pasach Hashem Otsaro v'yotze kli za'amo amarnu nigzeru lanu. V'lula Hashem tzvakos hoy sosir lanu sarid kimad gavanu kulanu. We were almost all killed, he writes. What is he describing? He's describing not just the reign of terror that was going on in Paris, he's describing anti-Jewish riots in Strasbourg. Because there were high tensions going on, especially in Alsace, between the Jewish community and the local Frenchmen. Now, even though the Jews had been emancipated to some degree by this point, there were long-standing tensions between Jews and their neighbors, particularly around one economic practice that was practiced by Jews, oftentimes because they were circumscribed in other ways that they couldn't do business, and that was usury.
Money lending,
exactly. Usury, charging interest. So there was a lot of tension. So because it was kind of a general period of chaos during the Reign of Terror, so there was a tremendous amount of anti-Semitic rioting taking place in Alsace and in Strasbourg. So he describes here how he saw with his own eyes the suffering, and he says, we were almost killed. And what did he have to do? He said they were svarim that were burned. He says he had to bury his own library, his own ksavim, that which he had written, out of the fear of the destruction of the marauders during that time. What does he then do? If you see in the next underline, ubiyosi ba'ela masei bepertzos drachim. He goes on the lam. He can't stay in Strasbourg anymore, so he starts to run away, and he's kind of moving from place to place in hiding, until finally things quiet down. He returns back to Strasbourg, and he sets to writing his Sfarim, his Chidushim, the Yad David, on Shas. And what you're looking at is the first of these volumes is published in 1799. Now, thank God, he says things have quieted down, and he can learn again, he can publish again, he has this library, everything is back to normal. Fine. So far, two stories. Napoleon Bonaparte, Rav David Zinsheim. But now they meet. In 1806, Napoleon is returning from battle. He passes through Alsace, and he hears a lot of complaints from the local French peasants about the Jews. And he has to figure out, what is he supposed to do with these guys? Because on the one hand, the Jews are, theoretically, they're citizens like everybody else. On the other hand, everybody's complaining about them, and everybody says they're crooked, and they're thieves, and they're disloyal to the French Republic. So what exactly should he do? This is the complaint that he hears. So he decides, and he decrees this on May 30th, 1806, he's going to gather a group of Jews, the leading Jews throughout France, for what he's going to call the Assembly of Jewish Notables. And the Assembly of Jewish Notables is going to deal with the basic questions of how to resolve the Jewish tension between their faith and their country. Are these people capable of being French citizens, or are they not? So there is a tremendous amount of fascinating research on this topic. And one article that I used to prepare for this, if you look on the next page on page 5, comes from a periodical called Midstream. The author of this article is Joseph Sungalowski, who is a professor of French in Queens College in New York, and he published this article in January of 2009. Joseph Zinsheim, President of Napoleon Sanhedrin and the First Chief Rabbi of France. This article is available for free online through some website. I'd never heard of the Midstream Quarterly Jewish Review. It's published by like the Theodore Herzl Memorial Society of some kind. It's been since 1955, it says. But I haven't seen it around.
It's not right. As popular.
It's not as popular now. So in this periodical, which is still published today, I'm not familiar with it. I think they said it was founded in 55. They have an article from this professor from Queens College, who himself, I think, was a child survivor from France. So he actually, I rely on him and some others to translate some of the original French sources on this, because my French is terrible. I don't know any French. So he has a fascinating, terrific article about this period of time, the Assembly of Jewish Notables, and then what happens afterwards. They convene on July 29th, 1806, and they have questions that are posed to them. And this is page 6 that you're looking at right now. Count Molay was one of the negatively disposed toward the Jewish people, one of the ministers of Napoleon. Now, the place to look for this is in this volume. If anybody is interested in modern Jewish history, you must have this. Yeah. It's not an expensive volume. It's easily accessible. I think they probably have thousands of copies. If you want it used, you can get it online. This is called The Jew in the Modern World. It's edited by Mendes Flohr and Reinhardt from Brandeis. They have a collection of original sources on all areas of modern Jewish history: political, racial, anti-Semitism, the State of Israel, modern Jewish studies, and then this section, which is what we're focusing on today, the process of political emancipation in Western Europe, 1789 till 1871. So he has a whole discussion about Napoleon, including, I didn't give you everything, but he begins with the imperial decree calling for an assembly of Jewish notables, May 30th, 1806, and then the document that you have in front of you now, Count Molay, what was his first name?
Louis Mathieu Mole, a member of the Council of State. He was one of Napoleon's three commissioners to the Assembly of Notables. As Napoleon's informal advisor on Jewish affairs, he advocated the rescission of Jewish emancipation. He was not from Unz. And then the reply comes to Count Mole from Abraham Ferdinand, who is a member of the Portuguese Jewish community of France. So we mentioned that there are going to be representatives from all different streams, all different aspects of Judaism. But what's fascinating, what we're going to see, is the questions that are posed and how they're going to deal, and the nature of these questions, how are you supposed to deal with this in the context in which they are living. So here are the instructions, and we'll go through the questions. I did not give you the answers. The answers are worthy of a shiur in and of themselves. That's a fascinating discussion to see how they answer them, but that's not our focus today. So I'm skipping the preamble. Go to the right side. And remember, the life of the Jewish community hangs in the balance here in terms of whether they'll be emancipated or not and what their future is going to be. Here are the questions. Is it lawful for Jews to marry more than one wife? Is divorce allowed by the Jewish religion? Is divorce valid when not pronounced by courts of justice and by virtue of laws in contradiction with the French code? Just parenthetically here, keep in mind there's also another major tension going on in the background here, and that is the relationship between France and the New Republic and the Catholic Church and religion in general, because traditionally France had been the eldest daughter of the Church. And then with the Republic, there was a huge backlash against organized religion. So now Judaism is kind of like in this weird position that, you know, they're trying to figure out, are they more religiously bent? Are they less religiously bent? How what's the Republic's relationship to Catholicism, to the Catholic approach? And then what's it going to be toward the Jewish approach? Okay, because you know that the question about divorce is in the backdrop of the Catholic view of divorce and annulment, etc. Okay. Can a Jewess marry a Christian, or a Jew a Christian woman, or has the law ordered that the Jews should only intermarry among themselves? In the eyes of Jews, are Frenchmen considered as brethren or strangers? In either case, what conduct does their law prescribe towards Frenchmen not of their religion? Do the Jews born in France and treated by the law as French citizens consider France as their country? Are they bound to defend it? Are they bound to obey the laws and to follow the direction of the civil code? What kind of police jurisdiction have the rabbis among the Jews? What judicial power do they exercise among them? Are the forms of the elections of the rabbis and their police jurisdiction regulated by the law, or are they only sanctioned by custom? Are there professions from which the Jews are excluded by their law? Does the law forbid the Jews from taking usury from their brethren? Does it forbid or allow? Does it forbid or allow usury toward strangers? Those are some very difficult questions. Yeah. What makes it even more complex is that the composition of this group of the was known as the Assembly of Jewish Notables was very diverse, as we mentioned. They had liberal delegates who, when they were going to convene on July 26, 1806, convened on a Shabbos, and they rode there. Their Machal Shabbos. And then you had the more religious, observant members of the Assembly of Jewish Notables who walked. And they had ballots. So how did they conduct their ballots? So the people who were not as observant, they wrote their ballots on Shabbos. And the people who were observant had written their ballots on Friday. So there's this great tension. And who becomes the leader of the Assembly of Jewish Notables, who is the great rabbinic luminary of the time living in France? None other than Rav David Zinsheim of Strasbourg. He comes to Paris to compliment Abraham Ferdinand, who was the Sephardic. He was kind of like the lay leader of the Assembly of Jewish Notables, and Rav David Zinsheim comes, and he is responsible to navigate this tension between the pressure of all of French Jewry and finding acceptance in the eyes of Napoleon and the government, and on the other hand, a fealty to the halacha.
How did he get appointed to this job?
Because it was Yodua that he was the most senior rabbinic figure in France.
No, but how did the non, you know, the German, French, you know, Alsace-Lorraine people accept him as a...
He was known to be the most... he was the most prominent rabbinic figure. So he wasn't the only rabbinic figure, and he wasn't the only person to represent the Alsatian Jews, but he was the head of the Assembly of Jewish Notables because he was essentially the most senior rabbi in France. So this is an unbelievably complicated situation. So they come up, under the leadership of Rav David Zinsheim, they come up with answers, which, if you want to learn more about them, either we can take another Sunday to do that, or you can read them in here, which is worthy of its own study. They have the full answer to Napoleon's questions translated in here. Thankfully, it's not in French. And it's a fascinating dance. It's mamish a dance. You know, every word, you can see the care with which, you know, it's unbelievable to think about how careful they had to be. And at the opening of this council, Rav David Zinsheim delivered a drasha, and he spoke about the sacred duty to, on the one hand, be appreciative of Napoleon because they had been persecuted for so long, but on the other hand, they had to have this commitment to the halacha. So finally, they returned their answers in August, but Napoleon decides, you know what, that's very fine and good, but how do we make sure that this is really binding, that this is really significant in the eyes of the French Jewish community? So he says, you know what we're going to do? We're going to convene what is the most authoritative tribunal in Jewish tradition? The Sanhedrin. So we're going to convene a Sanhedrin in Paris. We're going to get 71 rabbis to come, and they're going to officially endorse, rabbinically, the words and the rulings of the Council, the Assembly of Jewish Notables. In 1807, the 71 rabbis gathered in, they met for the first time in February 9th, 1807. Who was the chief rabbi, the Av Beis Din of the Napoleonic Sanhedrin? None other than Rav David Zinsheim. And they had specific attire that they had to wear, and that's why I showed it to my kids because I thought they would think it was hilarious. If you go back to the front cover, that hat was not his own device. That was what they had told him. They had to wear a hat with
points.
Two points.
So apparently it's a machlokes among historians, whether that was a pejorative measure or it symbolized something positive. I don't know. I've never seen any other rabbi wear a hat like that.
It's right at the Ilchot Avrit.
Who knows? But it had felt and it had two... I don't know exactly what do you even call that. So this is what he had to wear. He had to wear a gown with a clerical flap, a sash, and a two-cornered hat with a fur border. That's what he had to wear. Kachava, and that's the portrait that you have on the front page. And he pronounced a prayer at the beginning. God of every creature, as we seek knowledge and learn what the people of Israel must do, do send us your holy advice. I'm reading a translation from the original. That's quoted in the article. So that we may not stray left or right from the path of your commandments, keep our eyes from seeing untruth, save us from error, instruct us how to speak, may we never say a thing against your will. And they met for the last time on March 9th, 1807, and Rav David Zinsheimer thanked the members of the assembly for not sacrificing, for not destroying and tampering with the sacred halacha, the tradition of Judaism that we had. And they formally adopted, this is going to be the governing text that will rule. Pursuant to this, that they go off, everybody is Shalom al Yisrael, except for Rav David Zinsheim, who is now sitting in Paris, and he becomes appointed the head of the consistoire. The consistoire, which still exists today, the consistoire is the central rabbinic organization sanctioned by the state of France. What did Napoleon decide? He says, okay, you know what we're going to do? We're going to have a Rabbanut HaRashit in France. You know, we had this Sanhedrin, this is Geschmack, everybody was happy, very good. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to institutionalize, remember, because in France, the age-old relationship between church and state is no problem, so we're going to institutionalize the position of the rabbinate. So they had several rabbis who were, I don't want to say ordained by the state, but regulated and set by the state. And who was the leading rabbi among these rabbis, none other than Reb David Zinsheimer. So now Reb David Zinsheimer is in France, and he's sitting in Paris. He's not in Strasbourg anymore. So he publishes another set of Sfarim called Minchas Ani. Why are they called Minchas Ani? Look on the next page, page 7. Karasi Shema Kuntras has said Minchas Ani. I call this new document, this new Chidushi Torah, Minchas Ani, the gift of the poor. Kichibarti also ba'anius shel Torah. I wrote it in the impoverished state of Torah, Po Ha'ira Paris, because I'm stuck in Paris, Michusar Svarim. I don't have my Svarim, Hanitzrachim, Michusar Zman, Liosi Tzorech Lasuk, but Tzorechi Rabim. Because I have so many headaches from dealing with Napoleon and all these other affairs of the state, I can't sit and learn like a mensch. So here I am, I'm going to call my sefer the pauper's work, because I have no Svarim and I have no time. So I'm going to write 2 volumes of essays called Minchas Ani. Afal pi kein, nonetheless, writes Reb David Zinsheim, lo bital to me beis hasefer afilu sha'achas le'itos apnai. Whenever I had a free minute, at least I went back to learn. Achala no pnei Hashem ve'eranias nevei kodesh bayis beisi mole svarim. I hope that one day God will bring me home to my house where I have all my svarim. Imagine this poor rabbi just wants to go home and learn. Meanwhile, he's sitting in Paris. Va'od oshiv yadei al advar manei amorim bekuntresi. Hakosi v'chosim po Paris erev Shabbos Kodesh Parshas Chukas Shnas Tuf Kuf Samach Tes, which is Tuf Kuf Samach Tes. I think that's 1808 or 1809. That's when he writes the Minchas Ani. So this is kind of like the end years of Rav David Zinsheim, where he's continuing to publish, but he's out of his element. He says, My whole Svarim library is in Strasbourg, and I'm stuck here being the chief rabbi of France, living in Paris. November 1812, Rav David Zinsheim passes away. He's buried in Paris. His tombstone lay for many centuries neglected, but if you go back to that page where I have that, you'll see on the right side, there's actually, this is a picture of a medallion that was minted in the time of the, it says, Grand Sanhedrin, Mai, and they give you the date. So this is a medallion that was minted in the time of the Napoleonic Sanhedrin. And on the left-hand side is the picture of the monument in the Parisian cemetery where Reb David Zinsheim is buried. You see where it says David Zinsheim, and then there's a whole epitaph all around the four corners of this. You see people, they left stones, looks like they left flowers. That's on page 5. You can see the picture of David Zinsheim's grave. But here's something, if it wasn't amazing enough, gets even more amazing, because obviously you can imagine Reb David Zinsheim, he lived a very conflicted life. On the one hand, his goal was to become a great Rav, a Torah scholar. And now he's dragged into the world of Napoleon, and he has to answer questions in a way that is a little bit uncomfortable. And when you go through the answers, you see how it's not a posh way to navigate this. So the question is, how did the traditional rabbinic community view Rav David Zinsheim and the way that he navigated this question? So there were different views. But if you had to pick out who was the most significant rabbinic personality of all of Europe in the first half of the 19th century, it would be who Rav Schwartz told me that he heard from Rav Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, to be referred to. The Rav said about this Rav that he was known as the engineer of halacha. And that was the Chassam Sofer. Chassam Sofer of Moshe Sofer of Hungary, from a Presburg. He had a major yeshiva, the Presburg yeshiva. Chassam Sofer was the, I'm going to say, it's not right to say the, but a towering figure. And especially think about what the role of the Chassam Sofer was in the first half of the 19th century in terms of navigating reform and emancipation. The Chassam Sofer was very famous for a phrase called Chodosh Aser Min HaTorah. Innovation is prohibited from the Torah. And the Chassam Sofer was Eish Lahava, very strong, ardently, stridently strong, against the nascent reform movement. So how is he going to look upon Rav David Zinsheim? So he tells us. Because on the next page, on page 8, I gave you one page of a 4-page hesped that the Chassam Sofer, Moshe Sofer, published in his Chidushim. It appears in 2 places. Delivered in Presburg in December 10th, 1812. And he tells you a mashal First he tells you a mashal, and then he describes this person, Rav David Zinsheim. Could you imagine? The Chassam Sofer himself gives a posthumous haskama to Rav David Zinsheim. Not only that, in the footnote here, they point out that the Chassam Sofer himself references the Rav David Zinsheim's commentary several times in his own work, the Yad David. And the Chassam Sofer says, I know this man because I exchanged letters with him. They had a personal connection. Rav David Zinsheim, the chief rabbi of Paris, the chief rabbi of France, the head of the Napoleonic Sanhedrin, and the great Eastern European Gaon, the Chassam Sofer, exchanged letters. He says, and now we'll read it inside. You see on the bottom, page 8. Asher kazeh hayamamish hatzadik hazeh. This tzadik, says the Chassam Sofer. Asher anu oskim behespedo, that today we are mourning his loss in a eulogy. Harav hagaon. Moreno harav David Zatzal Zinsheimer. Baal hamechaber sefer yad David. Asher bihioso mechubad. He was honored vikor of ma'od lamalchus beParis. He was close to the leadership in Paris. Vinishal al kamo dvarim. And he was asked several questions. And we know what those questions were. We know exactly what the Chassam Sofer is referring to here. Veheshiv sholov. And he answered the questioners. Davar vahaya gadol u'mechubad ma'od be'enei ha'melech v'hasarim. V'kavar osu lo b'moso kayadua. They made him a great state funeral. They gave him great honors after his death. Ubacholzos Hayagorol Yehudim. Ose Kol Yomov Batorah, he was learning his whole life. Vehsira Shas Kamapa'amim. He reviewed all of Shas several times. Vachol Sifra Rishonim Vacharonim Hayamama Shigurim Befiv Kanir Misifro. And it's clear from his Svarim, Chassam Sofer says, that I learned. It's clear that he knew the works of the Rishonim and the Acharonim. Umakiro hayisi bialdusi. I knew him when I was younger. Vegam atay dechiluch ksavim imo raisi tzidkaso v'tamuso. I saw his righteousness in the exchange of letters that we had. So he says on the top, nimtza milavad shenasa adon. Aside from the fact that he became a master, al yedei chachmaso benimusiim uvamidinius, he wasn't just a political figure. He wasn't just an activist. O nishar hu hamoshel begvuroso. He was still ruling in his own, meaning he was governed by Torah, by his tradition, by himself. Velo mashlu heimbo. They, the secular French, didn't control him. Sheyispata acharem chas v'shalom, that he should somehow be seduced after them. Ela achar shegila lehem tefach chazal achasos tfachayim. After he revealed one tefach, he closed it up with two. Which is a Talmudic expression from somewhere else. Chassam Sofer says, let me tell you a mashal, a story. You have a king who has a cloak. And the cloak is made out of beautiful, fine fabric. Beautiful cashmere, the finest, most expensive, beautiful wool. A red cloak. And all over this cloak is made for the emperor. The emperor, he places medallions. And each of these medallions represents something else. One represents a battle that he won over here, and an award he won there, and an honorary this, an honorary that, to the point where all of his accomplishments are covering the whole garment. And when he walks around, the people are mamish dazzled, and they're inspired. They see all of these accomplishments. They say, it's amazing. And Kol Tuv, you know, credit to him. But one day, one of the local advisors says, you know what, Your Honor, it is beautiful, it's very unique that you have all these different medals and all of these medallions and accomplishments, but you know, we don't get to see the beautiful cashmere uniform underneath. You know, the fine wool, we don't get to see it. See, and he says, you know what, let's do this. Why don't you take off all the medallions? And this way, everybody will be able to see and appreciate the beautiful cashmere jacket that you have. The king says, oh, it's a good idea. And all the other ministers say, yeah, it's a good idea, Except for one guy, there's always one sour face in the corner. He's clearly upset. He says, terrible idea. The king doesn't look at him very much. So they go ahead, they take off all the medallions. And he comes back, and the king looks really nice. He has this beautiful cashmere jacket, and everybody's, ooh, ah. And he comes outside, and he waves to all the people. Everybody's like, ooh, ah. And he sees still the sour face in the corner, still upset. So the emperor goes over to him and says, what's your problem? Isn't this a nice idea? So the minister says, Your Honor, I have to tell you, I do not agree with these guys. He says, I'll tell you why. Because yes, it is a beautiful cashmere jacket. Very nice, very good, very fine. You're going to walk out there. You'll be among the people. Everybody's going to say it's a beautiful cashmere jacket. But you know what's going to happen in 5 minutes? All of a sudden, you're going to see around the neighborhood, everybody's going to be popping up with cashmere jackets. And the people who can afford it are going to get nice cashmere jackets. And they're going to look just like your cashmere jackets. And then all of a sudden, it's not going to be so special anymore. He says, you know what you should do? If you want people to see the jacket, here's what you should do. You should keep all of your medallions. But once in a while, when you go out, take a few off over here. And people will see, oh, it's a beautiful cashmere jacket underneath. Otherwise, they won't see it. And then the next week, you put it back on. And then you take off a different medallion somewhere else where they could see. And they'll get an appreciation for the jacket. But you won't lose the uniqueness of your medallions. This is delivered in December of 1812. For Erev Parshas Shabbos Kodesh Parshas Vayigash. This is right around the time of a fast. The fast of Asar B'Tevis. Says the Chasam Sofer in the introduction to the Hesed, he says, why is it that everybody was so upset when the Greeks translated the Torah? That the world, the Medrash says, the world was dark for 3 days and everybody was depressed. The Chasam made a fast day out of it. It's horrible. Why? Now everybody has access to it. And now, he says, the Greeks see the great brilliance of Judaism. Chasam Sofer says, I'll tell you why. Because yes, there is ki hichachmaschem ubinaschem la'ene ha'amim. There is great brilliance in Jewish wisdom, in Jewish life. And there are a lot of people outside, even today, who when they see the system of halacha that we live by, they say, you know what? It really is a proper way to conduct your life. There's a rapper today. I don't know if I should quote him because I'm not sure exactly. I don't know rap and I don't know what he says out there. But he became, I don't know if he was in his guy or he became a Orthodox Jewish. You see all these videos. It's a mamish gangster rapper. His name is Shine, Shyne. See, has a whole shtickle Torah, kiviyachol, on YouTube where he describes how now he lives an Orthodox Jewish lifestyle, so it gives him boundaries. You know, before that, he was doing who knows what. I'm not going to ask what he was doing. He says it gives you boundaries. See, people see, you know, they see not that Judaism is a panacea and not that that is the substitute for making good decisions in life, but it's a good framework. But he says that's only one half of the story. There's so much more that's beyond the apprehension, the brand appreciation of just, you know, the average society. And that's really what distinguishes Torah learning. Torah is not just, you know, a nice book of ideas that everybody can share and appreciate together. There's so much more there that not everybody gets, and there's so much depth to it. So what was the tragedy, he says, of translating the Torah was removing all the medals from the cashmere jacket. And now it's just a cashmere jacket, so it's a book of good advice, and there are other books of good advice. He says, What we're trying to do is trying to navigate this relationship where on the one hand, yes, we can show the world that we have a cashmere jacket that's beautiful and meaningful, but we also have something that's unique to us, our accomplishments and things that are special. Says the Chasam Sofer, you know what Rav David Zinsheim was successful in doing? He was able to relate to Napoleon, the French government, in exactly this way. He was able to find common language in the cashmere jacket, but he did that without ripping off all of the medals, all of the uniqueness, all of the exclusive traditions that are unique to us. This is the Chasam Sofer's Hesped from Rav David Zinsheim. So now we turn to our Shtickel Torah for today. Page 9. This is this week's Parsha, the comments of the Shalal David. So the Shalal David is Rav David Zinsheim's commentary on the Chumash. Va'ira el Avraham el Yitzchak ve'el Yaakov b'kel Shakai. So David Zinsheim begins with a series of questions. Why do we need, for example, on line 9, all these lashonos of Vahotseisi, Vitzalti, Vigaalti, and why do we need Avram to Hashem to invoke the promise to Avram? So let's start on line 10. Vihine, kvar kasafti, I've written before, daharben b'farashim, many explained, d'dal me'ashana hischilum b'shanolad Yitzchak. The 400 years, right? It says we're going to be exiled for 400 years, bris mit abasarim. But wait a minute, if you do the numbers in Egypt, how long were we there for?
210.
210. So which is it, 210 or 400? So it doesn't work. So here's the problem. How do you fix it? So he says, I'll tell you what it is. Line 11. One answer is, Be'eretz lo lahem, it was not their land. Ve'eretz Yisrael lo lahem hava delo zachu ba'avos rak oson shenichnesu la'aretz. First answer is, maybe even though Yitzchak lived there, it didn't belong to him yet. So that's why it was Be'eretz lo lahem. Ve'amina de'eretz Yisrael hayalahem, I'm on line 12. Tzorech lomar, Dekoshi hashibud hishlim. You know why? They only lasted 210 years. What's the answer? Because it was so severe that 210 years of absolute back-breaking, unbearable suffering is the equivalent of 400 years. This is the other answer, how to resolve this problem. So he says, and the Medrash says that on Rosh Hashanah, the hard work stopped, but they were still working until Nisan when they were totally redeemed. Now line 15. V'zesha amar lafisha Moshe Rabbeinu hayem mefakpik v'amar Moshe Rabbeinu was wondering v'hatzer lo yitzalto es amecha, you haven't yet saved your people. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu ani Hashem v'akayim havtachasi l'ga'olam, I will fulfill my promise v'hu migimol time mechuyav ani la'asoso. Now Rav David Zinsheim says, based on this idea, three reasons why he says to Moshe, I have to save you. Number one, on line 17, Tchila va'era el Avraham el Yitzchak v'chule mikoach chibasam v'havasam zchusam. Number one, because I loved our forefathers, I have to keep my promise. Number two, line 18, va'od gam ani mechuyav lahakim et brisi l'aslam et seretz kanayin, I have to give them the land. So now it says to Moshe Rabbeinu, Shema tomar lo tishlam hazman, maybe you'll tell me it's not 400 years yet. So then Hashem says, don't worry. Lo kein, shahari lo hayal ela eretz megurehem asher garuva. It was only a land in which they sojourned. So this is teretz number one. Moshe Rabbeinu says, Rabbeinu Shalom, it's not time to get out. So God says to him, not so fast. Number one, it wasn't their land yet. Teretz number one. Line 20. V'im kein haya shapir eretz lo lahem. It was the land that didn't belong to them. V'il nishlamu dald me'oshana. V'gam, he says, and also, what is the pasuk, the next pasuk in this week's parasha? V'gam ani shamati es na'akaz b'nei Yisrael. I also heard the screams of the Jewish people. What does it mean I heard their screams? The suffering was terrible. V'im kein, v'gam, he says, on line 21, Ani shamati es na'akaz b'nei Yisrael asher Mitzrayim avidim osam, dahainu koshi hashibud, the extra hard work. V'im kein, ze gorim gam kein lahashlam azman, afilu lohaya b'lav hachi shalem. Even if you want to tell me Moshe Rabbeinu, well, it's their land. So Rabbi Shalom says, v'gam ani shamati es na'akaz b'nei Yisrael. I also heard that the suffering was so terrible. And therefore, now come the four lashonos of Geula. Why? Line 24, Me'ata now, vohotzeisi eschem. I'm going to take you out right now. Takef mi Rosh Hashanah. Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, right now it's Rosh Hashanah. I'm going to take you out. Mitachas sivlos Mitzrayim. The first step is going to be, I'm going to take you out from what? The sivlos, the hard work. Shibur hakoshe. Va'achakach benisan shenishlam hazman. When the time comes in Nisan that it should be completely over, then line 26, v'itzalti eschem me'avodaschem me'avodasam legamri. Then you're not going to have to work at all. Then you're going to be totally finished. Afilu avodakala shahaya bein hazman hazeh v'kevon shinishlam hazman ayidei dald me'oshana. Since the time is up of 400 years, v'koshi hashibur hayishalo kedin, and the suffering was so much worse, me'ata. Therefore, now what am I going to do? V'go'alti haschem b'zorah nitu v'shvatim gedolim. Now I'm going to do v'go'alti through punishing the Egyptians. Why should I punish the Egyptians? What did they do wrong? The answer is, you know what they did wrong? Al-koshi hashibud. Kamosha Kasav Haravid. The reason why I'm punishing the Egyptians is not because they enslaved you. You were supposed to be enslaved, but who says they had to do it L'mahadrin? You know? They were supposed to be your taskmasters. They had a geshmak out of it. That's what they're going to get punished for. Kodesh b'teitzu l'gamru teidu k'ani Hashem. Top of the next column. B'asher kvar hotzeis yeschem mitachas sivlos Mitzrayim d'havu shibur hakoshe v'nasati yosalachem morosha. Da'ad heina lo haya morosha sha'avos lo darubo rak b'geirus. Now comes the end. What does it say? V'galti yeschem v'zoranituya v'lokachti yeschem li la'am v'yisilakem l'lokim. And I'm going to give you the land of Israel. Why? Because now you're going to get the land of Israel to conclude the process. So what Rav David Zinsheim is saying is Moshe Rabbeinu is almost like having like a lomdusha argument with God. Moshe Rabbeinu says, no, you tell me we're going to go out, but it's not time. The Baruch Shalom says, no, I'll give you a lomdusha shir, mamonav shach. If you're going to tell me that the Avos live there, you'll say it's Eretz Lohem. And even if it was Eretz Lohem, this was still an extra hard shibud. And that's what he's saying is the meaning of the psukim of the four lashonos shel geula. Number one, you should know that there was an extra harsh shibud here, and therefore you're going to get out. And for that reason, I'm going to punish the Egyptians because of the extra hard work that they gave you. And on the other side, if you're going to tell me that the Jewish people didn't yet own the land, for that reason I'm going to bring you to the land and settle you there, because now then the 400 years are really going to be up. So between the two, he says, Moshe Rabbeinu, trust me, it's time to go. So let's go take them out. So this is Rav David Zinsheim's Teich. So you see what he's doing in his Pirush on the Chumash here is he's taking his Talmudic knowledge and kind of making a pilpul out of discussion between Moshe Rabbeinu and the Rabbanu Shalom. He has another vart, which we're not going to take the time to review today. So you can look at it on your own. On the last page, I just gave you the Encyclopedia Judaica's quick write-up, the summary of the life of Rav David Zinsheim and how he served in both as the Rosh Yeshiva in Bishheim, and then in Strasbourg, and then in Paris. Ultimately, all the Sfarim that he writes, and then the Hesped from the Chasam Sofer. You see there's more biography there on the bottom. If you want to learn more, you can take a look at that essay that's published online. But this is the fascinating episode of the Napoleonic Sanhedrin, the Sanhedrin that was convened by Napoleon himself, and then the great rabbinic luminary, Rav David Zinsheim, this, I guess, a largely unknown figure in Jewish history, at least unknown to me until I learned about him, this unknown figure who was not just a great Talmud Chacham, not just a Rosh Yeshiva, but also later became the founder of the Consistoire, which exists today. I could tell you when I had the privilege of being in France, I met the chief rabbi of France at that time and had an opportunity to meet with some of the people from the Consistoire, take a tour of the great synagogue, etc., the head shul of the Consistoire in France, and hopefully all the French Jews will be safe. With all of Am Yisrael, we should have a Besuras Tovos. Have a great week. Yeah. Go ahead. Okay.